Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Welcome to the brightest audience in the country. I'm Fred Williams, host of Real Science Radio.
And I'm Doug McBurney, the host of the Weekly Worldview. It's great to be back with you, Fred, and everyone here at the Real Science Radio audience. We've got to focus you, Fred, on keeping your promise this week. That's the first.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's that promise I've made like every show the last 15 shows. Okay, maybe
it's been a while.
Two or three shows about dinosaur mummies. It's a story we've been wanting to get to, but we got so wrapped up.
But wait, before we get to that story, Fred.
We've got a 50-minute topic.
Well, wait. I have a cautionary tale. Before we get, and we're going to get to the mummy here, because this will only take a second. This is a cautionary tale for all the boys and girls out there. This is from PJ Media, a French scientist. This was back in August. I'm not sure if you've seen this, Fred. It caught my eye. A French scientist, but back when the Webb Space Telescope, Fred, you remember, it first started sending back pictures, right? Mm-hmm. And it was all over the news. Everybody was talking about it, right?
Yeah, I remember that.
Yes, and the evolutionists were all shocked and stunned and surprised, and all that was going on. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun for us here at Real Science Radio. It's always fun to see the big banger shocked. But when all that was going on, French physicist Etienne Klein posted an image of what he called our closest stellar neighbor.
I remember that now.
Proxima Centauri. Mm-hmm. The post that he put up, it garnered thousands of likes and retweets, and he had written under it, this level of detail, a new world is revealed day after day.
What's the punchline?
It turns out that Klein had tweeted out a photo of a slice of sausage. It was a close-up of a slice of sausage with little bits of fat and a little bit of red and a little orange and a little white. And anyway, so PJ Media posted this so that we could all get a chuckle. But what caught my eye was that PJ Media said no one should feel embarrassed about being tricked.
Well, you know, it's so funny. You know what that reminds me of? Creation Magazine on the back cover one time, they had a picture, this artistic picture. And they had quotes from these people looking at, oh, this is so wonderful, and look at the detail over here, and the exquisite way that they decided that this should be shaped over here, and all these comments from these eclectic, weird people who like art, who claim they like art. And it turns out it was a monkey just randomly splashing paint on the wall. You know, well, see, people's taste, so, I don't know.
Well, and so, Fred, if you're part of that group that publishes the critique, and then you find out it was actually a monkey splattering, at that point, I think you should be embarrassed. And so
true.
The fact that PJ Media says, look, if you thought this sausage story was real, you shouldn't be embarrassed. I want to take umbrage with that and say that you should be embarrassed. You should be embarrassed after the fact when you find out you were duped. Otherwise, Mr. Author at PJ Media, if you say nobody should ever be embarrassed about being tricked, then you're contributing to the devolution of responsibility and intelligence. Not feeling embarrassed is like never saying you're sorry. It leads, at the very least, to trouble and to problems. And at the very worst, it leads straight to hell with jet rockets. So you should feel embarrassed. Sometimes, and you should even repent sometimes, and even say you're sorry, and you should even humble yourself sometimes.
But before you do all that, before you realize you're embarrassed and humble yourself, I do have several paintings I'd like to sell you.
There you go. I love it. All right. Now, before we run out of time, Fred, we've got to get to the dinosaur mummy. This is from phys.org.
Drum roll, please. We're finally getting to the dinosaur mummy.
Yes.
So, Doug, what's this article all about?
So it's about a juvenile hadrosaur, and it fizz.org reports that it's so well preserved that you can see the individual scales, and they can see some tendons, and it looks like there's going to be skin over the entire animal. That's according to Brian Pickles, a paleontologist and a professor of ecology at the University of Reading, which I believe is in, well, it's either in Pennsylvania or it's in England, because there's a Reading in both.
Okay. Well, ironically, his last name is Pickles, because yes. He goes on to say...
Oh. That's very well preserved.
Yeah, he says, in the best case scenario, this creature's stomach contents might be preserved, allowing scientists to determine the animal's last meal, Pickles said.
You can't make this stuff up. All right, now, Caleb Brown over at Canada's Royal Tyrrell Museum, not the regular Tyrrell Museum. This is Canada's Royal Tyrrell Museum. He spotted the fossil poking out of a cliffside at the Dinosaur Provincial Park in Alberta, Canada. Isn't that wild that in a universe that's, what, 13 billion years old and on a planet that, how old is the planet, Fred? It's like 4 or 5 billion?
Yeah, 4.6 is where they have it now, 4.6 bill.
What are the odds that you happen to be alive and walking by a cliffside when a fossil just happens to be sticking out of it? It's just amazing.
Yeah.
And this guy's like the luckiest man in the universe. Anyway, he says it's hard to imagine this animal died 76 million years ago. Now, there's a statement I can agree with.
That it's hard to imagine.
He says it's been perfectly preserved, and it just happened to be starting to erode out of this cliff when we were walking by. If you run the math on the odds of that actually happening.
Yeah, 76 million years this thing's supposed to be there. Oh, and by the way, I'm walking by it, and it's just now starting to, it pops out and it's starting to erode. But I was lucky. For 76 million years, this thing's been preserved perfectly. He says perfectly. And now, by golly, I'm going to go buy a lottery ticket.
Right. You better hurry, right? Wow. Now here, listen now. Now, Pickles comes back here. Pickles says this. He says, this animal probably either died and then immediately got covered over by sand and silt in the rivers, or it was killed because a riverbank fell on it. Now, that's not hard to imagine. That sounds plausible, actually.
Yeah, but what would cause that? I mean... I'm wondering. He says a riverbank, it just falls on it. Okay. Falls. Okay. How'd that happen? Was there a bulldozer? We don't know about Fred Flintstone. They actually had bulldozers 76 million years ago and they pushed that riverbank onto it.
You saw Fred's feet turn into that swirling black circle.
And Wilma was yelling, no, don't do that.
Well, if a riverbank fell, then there had to be some catastrophic event happening, right? I mean, that's what I would assume.
Yeah, it had to have died immediately. So, you know, that sounds like rapid burial. And that's, again, evidence for a global flood, because it's not, you know, it's well preserved. There's no way this thing has spent 76 million years not decaying. I mean, that's ridiculous.
I know.
They have no process they can explain that keeps these things around for that long.
No. By the way, we'll post a link to the article at fizz.org. Pickles concludes by estimating the dinosaur to be about 13 feet long, and Real Science Radio concludes by estimating the dinosaur to be about 4,000 years old.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's reasonable. Give or take. Yes. Now, Fred, it's telethon month. So now that you've kept your promise and we've gotten to the dinosaur mummy, which is just frankly amazing. We'll have to add this to the list of the dinosaur soft tissue. We do want to remind everyone that it's telethon month. Our goal is $30,000. Keep Real Science Radio on the air for another year. We are so thankful that you're in the audience listening. We want you to join us. We want you to join us and help us stay on the air. You can go to rsr.org, click through the giant telethon banner. You can subscribe to one of our monthly resources. You can actually sponsor one of these shows. And if you want, we'll even shout your name out on the air on AM670, the 50,000 watt blowtorch of the gospel. You can have your name go all out to the entire Western United States, or you can do it anonymously, sponsor a show, sponsor half a show, sponsor a year's worth of shows. Subscribe to and download any one of the numerous incredible resources that the late, great Bob Enyart built up over the decades to edify and enlighten the world and hopefully help pull the world back from the precipice. You can be a part of all that, folks. We need your help at the telethon. We want you to join us. Go to rsr.org, click through the banner, and support us. Help us raise $30,000 to keep Real Science Radio on the air for another year. Okay, Fred, there. So yeah. You've gotten that out of the way now, too.
Well, and I just typed in rsr.org, and sure enough, there's a really big banner at the top. You cannot miss it. It says telethon, and I click it, and cool, there's a web page that has all kinds of neat resources that you've already gone through, Doug. You've gone through a lot of them. You know, I just listened to the Tree of the Knowledge of Good and Evil. That is such a cool Bible study. So that's not listed on this one page, but you can find it in the store, along with so many other great material. I'm telling you, that, and I know you just gave a Bible study on the Tree of Knowledge of Good and Evil. It's incredible.
Fred, I got to tell you.
It's incredible.
I got to tell you, Fred. I took Bob Enyart's teaching on the Tree of the Knowledge of Good and Evil, takes a significant portion from Ezekiel that most people, at least not me, I had never associated with the book of Genesis. But when you read it, so what I did at my Bible study, it'll blow your mind, by the way. What I did at my Bible study was I turned that section of Bob's teaching on the tree, I turned it into like a fictional narrative. And I read it for about 15 minutes as if it's from like a fictional novel. And I just added some details as to how the events might have unfolded. And at one point, one of the guys in the Bible study, when I came to a pause, he said, "Are you reading from the Bible or something else?" And I said, "No, I'm embellishing the story." And then I had to get back. But it is a phenomenal study, the Tree of the Knowledge of Good and Evil, not only to help you better understand what happened to the Tree of Knowledge, what happened to the Tree of Life, what happened in the Garden of Eden, but also what is the relationship between law and grace for the believer? And how do we get to know God better? Is it through the law or is it through a relationship? It's a tremendous study, the Tree of the Knowledge of Good and Evil. Phenomenal. One of the greatest resources that the late, great Bob Enyart produced. Yeah. Definitely welcome to get that.
And that 15-minute story you told, Bob does something similar in that Bible study. And I remember when I was hearing that, I was like, okay, this isn't in the Bible. So I went and read all of Genesis, and I couldn't find it. And I'm like, okay, because I was listening to it driving to work, so I hadn't heard it all. I just heard that part. Got into work, and I arrived home, one of the two, and I jumped on the Bible. I'm like, okay, and I literally, I think I read all of Genesis. I'm like, this isn't in here. Well, it turns out it is. That story is in the Bible. That's a teaser for you guys to go out and get that material, get that Bible study, the Tree of the Knowledge of Good and Evil. It is, I'm telling you, it's fantastic. I would recommend this to anybody. If you're an unbeliever, that thing's going to open your eyes on a lot of truths, and oh, yeah. Just everything is so wonderful in that bookstore. You've got Bob's plot of the Bible. That is clutch material that you need to have that in your library. If you don't,
That reminds me, Fred, anyone who signs up for a monthly sponsorship, sponsors a show month to month, they'll get a copy of the second edition of the plot.
That's great. And my producer just flashed me a note. The Tree of the Knowledge of Good and Evil will now be added to the front page of that telethon area on the store. So, hey,
cool.
Lots of great materials. So, Doug, back to the Hydroplate Hammers. Last week,
yes.
We kidded around about me being nicknamed Fred the Hammer Williams. Well, how about Kevin the Hammer Lee?
Hey, there you go.
Kevin's got a great story on DART. Now, what is DART? D-A-R-T.
Well, it's DART, D-A-R-T, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test. This is where the government, if there's an asteroid that might be a threat to the Earth, then the government wants to figure out a way to redirect the asteroid, which I think is a legitimate function of government, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So
and they've
it's
got like
there,
zillions of Hollywood movies of, you know, this type of thing. So.
Oh, absolutely. But here's the thing. And one thing we learned from the hydroplate theory is that all of the asteroids and the comets flying around out there are the result of the fall. They're the result of sin. And there's a good chance that they could be very dangerous. In fact, we know from the evidence on the Earth that some of these asteroids have been extremely dangerous and caused tremendous amounts of damage with their impacts.
Yeah. And we know from the hydroplate theory, they came from Earth. That's surprising to a lot of people. All that stuff flying around out in space. And frankly, Doug, they're kind of ugly. I mean, they're rock piles. They're dirt.
Yes.
They're snowballs, dirty snowballs. They're ill-shaped, you know, goofy-looking, and yet you have some creationists think that, oh, God just created those like they are and fly around.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, no, it makes a lot more sense from Walt Brown's hydroplate theory that those actually came from beneath the crust of the Earth in the subterranean waters and all that material and rocks and stuff being shot up into space, achieving escape velocity, pummeling the moon. There's so many great materials on the hydroplate theory. But yeah, so... what did Kevin Lee have to say about this?
Well, I have a copy of a message that was posted by Kevin Lee on September 27th. This was before any of the photos that were the result of this DART impact on the asteroid Dimorphos. Before any of the photos were released, Kevin published, he says, since DART confirmed what HPT advocates suspected, Dimorphos is a rock pile. I thought I'd take a stab at predicting what the cameras will show when the pictures are released.
Okay, so Dimorphos, that's the asteroid, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And Kevin Lee, he's the hammer, and he's got the nerve to make predictions before the pictures come out. He says the impact of DART. Here's what he says. My guess, the impact of DART is similar to that of a cue ball hitting pool balls on the break, except that instead of the cue ball hitting 15 balls in a plane that are arranged in the shape of a triangle, DART is hitting millions of rocks of various sizes and shapes and dust throughout, all combined into a somewhat spherical shape. As such, one would expect that the energy of the DART impact, which is, by the way, is about 11.2 billion joules.
Hmm.
So you've got a 1,260-pound satellite traveling 14,000 miles per hour, striking Dimorphos with the energy of about almost 3 tons of TNT. Almost 3 tons of TNT. And he talks about how the rocks in the immediate area will then transfer some of the energy to the rock next to them and then to the rock next to those until the energy in each of the thousands of directions has created enough acceleration of enough mass to bring all motion to a stop in that direction. So the prediction from Kevin Lee is that the satellite will basically hit a big pile of rocks.
Yeah, because the hydroplate theory predicted long ago, actually, yeah, I think at least a decade ago, that we're going to find out that these asteroids are just really floating rock piles.
Right,
and that's where Kevin is basing his prediction. And that is so cool. So we're going to find out, right, whether or not Kevin's prediction and expectation comes to fruition or not. What do you think?
Yes, and there's not just like immediate predictions. He says he suspects that some of the surface rocks will be accelerated away from the surface. Kevin reminds us that Brian Nickel calculated the escape velocity for Dimorphos at about 4 inches per second. So any rock on the surface that receives enough impact energy to accelerate at 4 inches per second, it's going to escape the gravitational influence of Dimorphos and go into its own orbit or their own orbits around the sun.
Yeah.
And so Dimorphos will lose some of its mass. And Kevin says, despite NASA's promise that the DART mission would not create a hazard to our planet, it could put some of the ejected rocks into orbit paths that will someday impact the Earth. And he says, if so, I suspect they will call it the DART meteor shower. And so there's a prediction that's, I mean, that could be months away, years away, maybe decades away, depending on.
Science News.org or one of those places. Turns out the DART mission has created a meteor shower that we call the DART meteor shower.
Yeah, yeah. And they'll know that it came from DART. Yeah, yeah. So Kevin says, one thing's for sure. The DART mission planners thought they would be hitting a solid asteroid, which was based on what? On the Big Bang paradigm of how asteroids were formed. But the DART cameras were actually working for Walt Brown. and confirm what is expected based on the hydroplate theory. It's a rock pile.
Is there a sign together. Or a plaque on there that says working for Walt Brown or Walt Brown was here?
That's what they should have put that. They should have put that stamp on the front of that satellite. They could have stamped it on the first rock that it hit. That would have been appropriate. All right. So thank you, Kevin Lee. And so, Fred, does Kevin Lee have credentials that we should mention?
So, you know, Kevin actually worked in the nuclear engineering department at Puget Sound Naval Shipyard. The guy really knows what he's talking about. But, you know, predictions are the hard currency of science, and that's what he's doing here. And we're going to find out, you know, as we get more pictures from those cameras, we're going to find out how accurate his predictions are.
Yes.
If they had this as a line or an over-under on Vegas, I'd put the over on Kevin being correct. By at least I'd take even 7-1 odds. No, I'd take maybe 50-1 odds. I'd be willing to risk $50 to your one that he's correct. Maybe that's not brave enough, Doug. Maybe I should be more at 100, 200 to 1. But anyways, I digress.
It depends. It depends on how close are you to retirement. That would influence how big. Yeah. You know, the thing about Kevin Lee is Kevin Lee worked for a department over there in the Navy. It wasn't just nuclear engineering. They had to transfer that into actually making a ship move with nuclear energy. So talk about hard currency of real science. If the ship doesn't go, your engineering doesn't work. So Kevin Lee is eminently qualified, and we're thankful that he was paying attention to the whole DART mission. I watched it, Fred. I was watching it live. I was on the phone with a friend of Real Science Radio, actually, watching it live on TV. And when the impact happened, we both looked at it and we said, did we miss it? We were expecting to see something, but we saw nothing. Yeah. So it was kind of blurry and but
yeah, nothing.
But the data's coming in, and we'll see how Kevin's predictions hold up. And now I want to thank our good friend of Real Science Radio, Jane Albright, who sent us another hydroplate hammer.
All right.
This is an article Jane sent over from Watchers.news from September. It's about a desert tsunami. And it's basically a report on, again, how all scientists work for Walt Brown.
Okay. So what happened was a desert tsunami. What's a desert tsunami? Isn't there,
yes.
Is it deserts arid and dry? How can you have a tsunami in a desert?
Well, you go to the Devil's Hole. Now, the Devil's Hole is a cave, and it's a pool of water, and it's about 10 feet wide, 70 feet long, and it's more than 500 feet deep. It's located in the Amargosa Valley in Nevada.
That's
scuba divers
deep.
Go
wow,
there.
That thing is super deep.
Yeah, and if you take scuba classes in Colorado, if you pay an extra $1,000 or something, you can go get scuba qualified at the Devil's Hole.
Wow, okay.
I only know that because I took scuba lessons in Colorado, and that was one of the options that I could not afford. So instead, I went to a drainage ditch in Arvada where I was scuba qualified.
Well, let me just say it's not on my, what's the list called?
Your bucket list.
Yeah. Well, let me just say that's not on my bucket list. I might snorkel in that hole, but that's about it.
Okay. Well, the Devil's Hole is well-known and quite impressive. And recently there was a magnitude 7.6 earthquake in Mexico. That was back on September 19th. And it triggered a 4-foot-tall wave in Death Valley's Devil's Hole. And that's over 1,500 miles away. So you've got an earthquake in Mexico that causes the water in the Devil's Hole to ripple up 4 feet. That's pretty amazing.
Wow.
And according to the National Park Service, large earthquakes as far away as Japan, Indonesia, and Chile have caused the water to slosh in the Devil's Hole like water in a bathtub. Could it be, Fred, that there are underground chambers that still contain water that are all connected to each other?
Yeah, good point. You know, I wonder if tourists, when there's an earthquake, they all flock to that hole like they want to be in there when the thing's sloshing. Sloshing imminent. Within 10 minutes, you know, and everybody's flocking to that Devil's Hole. Well, that's interesting. Absolutely.
Well, the hydroplate theory and Walt Brown's flood model would predict that the underground chambers that contain the fountains of the Great Deep that they still exist to some degree. They're different than they were before the event, but they're still there, and that there would be water under there that would be generally all connected together. And so there is some evidence of that also in another Hydroplate Hammer article. Let's see. This is from a listener named Avery. He sent us the article. It says, all scientists work for Walt Brown. Oh, Avery wrote that part. Because that wasn't in the actual headline at fizz.org. Hold
on. No, it should be. If someday, I was their editor, it would be.
Someday. And in fact, I've come up with, because we live in the age of memes and stuff, I've come up with, all scientists work for Walt Brown. I've condensed that to A4B. So for all the millennials and whatever comes after the millennials, that you can just say A4B, and everybody who's hip and on the inside will know that you're talking that all scientists work.
Yeah, hashtag A4B.
That's it. Hashtag A4B if you want to be hip and you want to be on the inside. All scientists work for Walt Brown. This article is actually entitled An Ocean Inside the Earth? Water is determined to be hundreds of kilometers down inside the earth. I'll read a little bit from the article, Fred, if we have time. Do we have time?
We do.
I will read. The transition zone between the earth's upper and lower mantle contains considerable quantities of water, according to an international study involving the Institute for Geosciences at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. The research team there analyzed a rare diamond that was formed, Fred, that diamond was formed 660 meters below the Earth's surface. And study of the diamond confirmed a theory that there's water down there. No, that's not what they... Listen to this, Fred. This is where it gets a little bit largely speculative and biased, as you might imagine, from fizz.org. So the diamond tells them that there's water down there. So what do they deduce from that? They deduce that it's quite possible that subducting slabs carry deep sea sediments piggyback into the Earth's interior.
Yeah, they got to get plate tectonics in there. They're a little darling of, you know, plate tectonics, the thing that Baumgartner's trying to fit into the Bible. Yep, and here we are at fizz.org. What does that have to do with, you know, that's totally speculative. I like the part about the diamond. That's pretty good evidence. They've got good cross evidence that this thing really is from that deep beneath the Earth's crust, because they've got other material that they know about that it has in it. So that it's pretty good that this thing likely does come from that deep. And it just shows there was a lot of water down there. I like that kind of evidence because it's more direct than it is kind of relying on computer models and whatnot.
So and relying on a slab of Earth to carry sediments and water down into... That just doesn't make any sense. Anyway, but of course, we can see that the whole theory of plate tectonics, Fred, it's almost like a religion. It's just a really superstitious religion, but it has an influence on the secular scientists. Obviously, it's their baby. And our creation brothers and sisters keep trying to dress that baby to make it fit in our stroller, and it doesn't work. I'm sorry. But this diamond, on the other hand, now the stone contained numerous ringwood inclusions, which exhibit a high water content. And so this is evidence that this transition zone that I mentioned earlier between the Earth's mantle and its crust, and this is quite a vast amount of space, hundreds of kilometers, perhaps. I mean, no one's actually gone down there and seen it, but this diamond indicates that it's probably wet down there. And one of the authors of the article actually writes that this is getting us closer, bringing us one step closer to Jules Verne's idea of an ocean inside the Earth. And the transition zone high water content has far-reaching consequences for the dynamic situation inside the Earth and for plate tectonics, frankly, if there is an ocean down there. It doesn't bear up the theory of plate tectonics nearly as well as it would hammer home the idea of the hydroplate theory.
Yeah, they try to, you know, like they do with evolution, they'll throw the word evolution into whenever they're talking about something that's incredibly well designed. They'll have to pay their homage to evolution, even though it has nothing to do with what they were talking about and whatever incredible design of nature they're talking about. They do the same thing here. They gotta appease the god of plate tectonics.
That's it.
You know, this actually it's good evidence that this diamond, because again, it's more direct. It's more observational evidence. It reminds me of when Walt Brown was actually on 60 Minutes on CBS News when they were talking about the hydroplate theory way back when they had these two really deep holes they drilled in Russia, and then in one part was Germany's northern, I think in Bavaria. They drilled these things to like 7-8 miles deep, something like that. I'm going off of memory here. But to everybody's surprise, they were flowing with mineralized water, including salt water. It was all encased in crushed granite, just like the hydroplate theory had predicted. This is really good evidence for the hydroplate theory, to have water, you know, flowing through crushed granite. I mean, what a confirmation that was in itself. And here you just have more. Again, Doug, we talked about piling on, I think last week or the week before. It's just fun. We keep routing these poor evolutionists and plate tectonicites. Can I call them that?
Plate tectonicites. Plate tectonites.
You got all these ites in the Bible that eventually they go extinct, and eventually the plate tectonicites are going to go extinct. So
that's right. Hey, and by the way, Walt Brown proved the theory of how to appear on 60 Minutes without even having to show up. How impressive is that?
That's true.
60 Minutes went to work for Walt Brown, and he never even had to sign a paycheck for them. Pretty amazing.
Yep. Yeah.
So there we have our.
Yeah. We're standing up for the foundation of the Bible, for the truth. We're Real Science Radio. So please support us. Again, go to the website. Do whatever you can, even if it's the smallest amount. Just whatever you think you can do. Every little bit helps. And we love having you as an audience. Please continue to email in your questions, comments, suggestions. They've all been great. We love getting your ideas and your thoughts. We really appreciate it. It's been a great audience. And Doug, we're going to continue carrying the torch of Real Science Radio. I'm going to thank you again for joining us permanently as a host of Real Science Radio. This was your second show as officially a host, even though you've done quite a few with me over this last year. So that's all great. Wow. We're so excited to have you going forward.
Absolutely, Fred. I am honored and excited.
Yeah, and we've got some real exciting shows coming up. We've got a Creation Magazine show, and Ryan Williams will be joining us for that. And then we're going to have...
Always a blast when Ryan is on.
Absolutely. And we're going to do a series on plasma cosmology or Barry Setterfield. We're going to look into that. Real Science Radio is going to bring on a special guest to talk through that. That's going to be a really fun show. We've got another interview that we're lining up that is going to be so cool, Doug, and it has to do with echolocation.
Our special guest is super special. I can't wait. We've got to keep that one secret. Yeah.
Yeah, we will, but it's going to be so exciting when that happens. We got lots of great stuff planned for the show going forward. So for Doug McBurney, this is Fred Williams of Real Science Radio. May God bless you.